Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, July 31st, 2021, and we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in. Once again, to yet another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our regular Pan-African Newswire report with dispatches on the statistics released earlier this week, indicating that only 1.6% of people on the African continent have been vaccinated against the COVID-19 pandemic. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has expressed concern over the African Union Commission chair granting observer status to the Israeli government. Ethiopian scholars are calling for military action to end the rebellion by the TPLF in the north of the Horn of Africa state. And the interim prime minister of the Republic of Sudan has met with the foreign minister of Eritrea to discuss the situation in the neighboring Tigray province of Ethiopia. In the second hour, we listen to a briefing from the Director General of the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. John Nkengasong, on the status of the campaign to defeat the pandemic on the continent. Finally, we re-examine two of the race massacres of 1919, one in Elaine, Arkansas, another in Knoxville, Tennessee, and this comes just 2 months, the centenary of the Tulsa race massacre of 1921. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned, and we'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
Tout en France, quand on est à connaissance, il arrive un certain moment, c'est à l'âge de 18 ans, on s'aperçoit la nature. vida vient de changer. La vie n'est pas pour moi. C'est toujours pour une bonne qui lui tient bon langage. L'amour à ce jour le plus beau. Mais je reste avec un flambeau à la bande, reste détaché. C'est drôle de toute enfance, quand on est sans connaissance. Il arrive un certain moment, c'est à l'âge de 18 ans. On se perd dans la nature, car on découvre le sentiment. Quand sa vie devient étrange, devinez donc pourquoi. Ça a toujours été pour une blonde, qui lui tient bon langage.
Mama bébé, soki atinda kinga koloko, bamba sena moni pasele kelingai, awa na mboka ngai mopaya, ekende kingai mopembo na katanga sima na ngai, okati pesinga o, obotani malobo yo toloba na kinga yawa, na kondi na mabanzo. Tinda kinga koloko, bamba tena moni pasele kelingai, awa na mboka ngai mopaya. Ekende kingai mopembo na katanga sima na ngai, okati pesinga o, obosani malobo yo toloba na kinga yawa, na kongi na mabango. Leke leke na komi kolela zambe o, koyele mawa. Boka mosika nga mawa pati yonza meo. To yele mawa. Nakabinza to likolo ya boni nonza meo. To yele mawa. Leke leke na komi kole lanza mbeo.
Ebale ya Congo, ejali lo pangose, ejali tezela. Ebale ya Congo, ejali lo pangose, ejali tezela. Mite mandoki, bakoti songi songi, oh yeah. Bakaboli koko, babosani Afrika, oh yeah. mona yo motino. Oh, otambisinga imoto, otongi lumbumbashi. Laisse toi aimer, okomisinga imanerese, yebisa sokina landa. Onore miemi baba, kama na pulize yeyote. Lakini na kupenda.
Thank you. marche sous mes dessins. Amour par ami est loco. Amour par ami est pas beau. Tous mes dessins sont bien. Ay que te quiero, Minelia. Mi amas es tu medicina. Amor para mí es loco. Amor para mí es favor. Tu medicina está bien. Ay que te quiero, Minelia. Amor para mí es loco, amor para mí es favor. Tú me dices también, ay que te quiero, Minelia. Mi amante tú me dices, amor para mí es loco, amor para mí es favor. Tú me dices también, ay que te quiero. Minelia, una merengue, una merengue, una merengue, una merengue, una merengue, una merengue, una merengue.
Una merengue, una merengue. la paloma, y su paloma, que vuela, para no tornar.
Y mi corazón se mueve paloma por quererme tanto, porque yo no puedo vivir a más que fueres mi tanto.
Vuela la paloma, y su paloma, y vuela que vuela, para no tornar.
Y mi pa mira con esa mira ve que tu rostro bomba. Y te va a mezclar la tiene vaquera si te va tu paloma.
Vuela la paloma, y su paloma, y vuela que vuela, para no tornar.
Paloma, paloma, paloma mía, regresa a tu vida. Llévame tus alas, un vengo puedo comprar el olvido.
Vuela la paloma, y su paloma, y vuela que vuela, para no tornar.
Mosika yo zali koko Dilanga bile kie Nakani kinzambe Asala kinga pona yo Bolingwe bominga imiso Epe tinga liboma Nakani kinzambe Asala kinga pona yo Bolinge bominga imiso Epe tinga liboma Nakomi komi lela lela Tokola ngo bona moke Atana kangi motema Wapi mwaye na boya ye Nakani kinzambe Asala kinga pona yo Bolinge bominga imiso Epe tinga liboma Nakani sinzambe, asala kinga pona yo, bolinge bominga imiso, epe singa liboma. Nakani sinzambe,
kanisi nzambe asalaki nga mpona yo bolingi ebomi ngai miso epesi nga liboma naleli kokoae na kati ya bongi bolingo na yo sheri ekokoti na ngai lipelo na kanisi nzambe asalaki nga mpona yo bolingo ebomi ngai miso epesi nga liboma na kanisi nzambe asalaki nga mpona yo bolingo ebomi ngai miso epesi nga liboma.
Salut, passez, passez, bon, dis-moi, nous. Dame la que tú la tienes. La perita fue su
traía que burlar. Y ni traía fue pureza, siempre fue mi compay.
Dame la que tú la tienes, compay. Dame la que tú la tienes. Dame la que tú la tienes, compay. Dame la que tú la tienes.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast, and today is Saturday, July 31st, 2021. We are broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we just heard the music of Africa, classic Pan-African music from the 1960s and 1970s, featuring assorted artists such as Joseph Kabasele, Tabule Rashu, also the orchestra Congo Sousseis, as well as others. And that album, of course, is a compilation of various artists, mainly from what is today the Democratic Republic of Congo and the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. And these are just some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Our lead story deals with the current public health situation in Africa. The latest figures show that only 21 million people, or 1.6% of the African population, have so far been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. Addressing a virtual media conference of the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, WHO Regional Director Dr. Masidiso Mwete reiterated the importance of maintaining the momentum of current vaccine supplies to the continent. The target is to have at least 30% of the current population fully vaccinated by the end of this year, and we'll have that briefing right after the Pan-African Newswire segment. In South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa said that the continuing conflict in Palestine should have been enough to deny Israel observer status by the African Union Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mahamat. "We are concerned about the decision that has been made, and it is now a number of countries on the continent are expressing their unhappiness and dissatisfaction," said South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. South Africa's Department of International Relations has accused the commission chair of failing to consult with member states before granting Israel's request. The government said that granting Israel observer status was shocking following another year of its oppressing Palestine amid its ongoing illegal settlements. And you're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal, and these are some of the continuing headlines from today's Pan-African Newswire. In Ethiopia, the government must have outlined uncompromised and compromised conditions and take irreversible military action against the terrorist TPLF remnants if it is going to end conflict in the Tigray state via negotiations, so remarked several scholars. Now, this is an article that was published in the Ethiopian Herald newspaper. It says that Associate Professor of Sociology at Iona College in New Rochelle, New York, Therese Getachew, highlighted that if the TPLF quest for dialogue, it has to bring the fugitive and suspect TPLF members to the federal government. They have to disarm and willingly work for peaceful ends without any protest. Besides this, the TPLF has to announce officially that the Walkyat was part of Amhara Gondar's district before 1991. Just as the TPLF did, Amhara State has also claimed on this area. This area demands political and public solutions. TPLF has to stop their cooperation and conducting conspiracies with other rebel groups, he recommended. And finally, in regard to the situation in Tigray as well, but also involving both the Republic of Sudan and Eritrea, Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok received a message from Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki on the eight-month armed conflict in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Just 2 days ago, Usman Saleh, Eritrea's Minister of Foreign Affairs, and President Advisor Yamini Gebreab delivered a verbal message to Hamdok from Afwerki, according to a statement released by his cabinet. The statement said that the Eritrean leader responded to a message on the bloody conflict in Tigray from Hamdok, who is also the chairman of the East Africa Bloc, IGAD. In a recent message to a number of IGAD and African leaders, The Sudanese premier stressed the need to, quote, reach peaceful and political solutions in Ethiopia that ensures the unity of Ethiopia and meets the aspirations of the Ethiopian people, said the statement. He further urged to prioritize addressing humanitarian issues. Following the start of the fighting in Tigray last year, Hamdok proposed to mediate between the government and the TPLF, but Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed rejected the offer. In a statement released in Asmara, the information ministry stated that the two sides had, quote, frank and extensive discussions, unquote, and agreed on the need for a regional effort to overcome the, quote, internal and external challenges, unquote. And with that, conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment for our program. To read these stories in their entirety, all you have to do is go to the Pan-African Newswire website. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in various newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you have to do is go to our website, and that is at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to website for the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Not only can you have access to today's program by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal, but also you can have access to well over 1,000 other archived editions of our programs. The programs can be shared through emails, by posting the links on blogs and websites, and also through RSS feeds on blogs and websites, as well as through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Yeah, when the rain, do you remember how sweet it used to be? Just one.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. Today is Saturday, July 31st, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and that was none other than Ann Peoples with the classic R&B tune, I Can't Stand the Rain. And right now we want to move into a briefing from the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is from 2 days ago, featuring the Director General, Dr. John Nkengasone, discussing the status of the COVID-19 pandemic and the vaccination rollouts across the continent within the AU African Union member states. Let's listen in.
For disease control and the prevention, and he will be updating us on the COVID-19 situation across Africa, including the Africa CDC's response activities as it leads that drive against COVID-19 among the member states of the African Union. And then today we are also joined by Dr. Matshidiso Moeti, who is the regional director of the World Health Organization, the WHO Africa region. And she is here to talk to us about the vaccine acquisition in Africa. And then at about 25 past or 27 minutes after 11, we will then start our question and answer section. So please, if you have any questions, start firing them right away. And then, as usual, we'll then have our closing remarks and then bring the press briefing to a close. So let me now bring in Dr. John Nkengasone, who is the director of the Africa CDC, for his briefing on COVID-19 across Africa. Dr. John, you have the floor.
Thank you, Wayne, and a very good morning from Addis Ababa and from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at the head of the African Union Commission. But let me first of all join Wayne in appreciating Dr. Moeti's time for creating the opportunity and time to join me on this press conference today, and to acknowledge her dedication and extraordinary leadership that she has, she continues to exercise over the years in the fighting pandemics and epidemics and outbreaks on the continent. It's true joy, Chidi, to have you on this platform today with us at the African Union. As always, I will do three things: give you an update on the epidemiological situation, and then what we are doing, continue to do as Africa CDC together with in partnership with others, and what the vaccine situation is, which will largely be covered by Dr. Moeti. So in terms of the epidemiological update, as of today, July 29, a total of 6.5 million cases of COVID-19 have been reported across the continent, and this represents a 3.4% of all cases reported globally. The number of deaths, the total number of deaths for the entire continent stands at 867,000 people, unfortunately so, with a case fatality rate of 2.5%. And that number of deaths, that is the 157,000, represents 4% of the global deaths as we speak. About five countries are contributing to more than 63% of the cases on the continent: South Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, and Ethiopia. Four countries are now reporting a case fatality rate that is around 5%. That includes Egypt, Sahrawi Republic, Somalia, and Sudan. And 56% of our member states, that is 31 countries, are now experiencing a third wave of the COVID-19, with 23 member states experiencing a more severe third wave than the previous wave. Two additional countries, that is Ghana and Botswana, joined the list of countries with experiencing the third wave. And as we mentioned last time or last week, Algeria and Tunisia are experiencing the fourth wave already. In terms of variants, 38 countries are now reporting the Alpha variant, and we have no new additions to this list as of this week. 32 countries are reporting the beta variant with no new additions, and 21 countries are now reporting the Delta variant, which we've not recorded any new additional countries reporting that specific variant this week. Now, let me discuss the trends. I would, as usual, we'll look at the one-week trend that is comparing last week and this week, and then also look at the 4 weeks trend. So if you compare this week, this epidemiological week 29 with last week, which was the epidemiological week 28, we observed the following, that a total of 239,000 new cases of COVID-19 have been reported on the continent compared to last week, which represents a 15% decrease in the number of new cases. The highest proportion of new cases are from the Southern African region. That makes up about 57% of the cases, 30% in Northern Africa, 7% in East Africa, 5% in West Africa, and 1% in Central Africa. If you now look at the number of deaths, the total of 6,692 new deaths have been reported over this same period, that is the last from last week to now, representing a 9% increase in new deaths reported across the continent. So let us now look at the 4 weeks trends. That is the week between June 28th and July 25th. So there's been an average increase of 4% of new cases over that time period, with the breakdown as follows. 38% increase in Western Africa, 24% increase in Northern Africa, a 3% decrease in Central Africa, 1% decrease in Southern Africa, and a 0.1% decrease in East Africa. In terms of the new deaths over the last 4 weeks, we've recorded an average of 17% average new deaths over that same period, with the following breakdown in terms of the most populous countries. Nigeria, 29% average increase. South Africa, 27% average increase. Egypt, 32% average decrease. Ethiopia, 18% average decrease. DR Congo, 14% average decrease. And Kenya, no change. In terms of testing, as a continent, as of today, we have conducted about 58 million COVID tests. And last week alone, the continent conducted about 1.3 million tests, but that represents a decrease of about 19% over the previous week. The overall positivity rate stands at 11.2%, with a test per case ratio of 8.9, which means we are not testing at the level we should be testing. 31% of our member states or 17 countries are reporting tests positivity rate of higher than 12%, which means or reflects an extensive community transmission. The Africa CDC continues to support member states in their ability to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic, especially during this second wave. We have organized what we are calling the SWAP teams and deploy them to several countries, from Seychelles to Cameroon to Sierra Leone and Zambia, Namibia, to support them to fight the third wave. And I just came back last night from Tanzania to meet with the leadership of that country to continue to work with them and support the leadership there to implement a more aggressive COVID response a strategy. That is all part of the SWAP team that we've deployed across the continent. I will, as I indicated earlier, leave the vaccine piece to Dr. Moeti so that she can expand on that. So Wayne, please, I'll turn back this the floor to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John, for that briefing. And now let me introduce Dr. Matshidiso Moeti. And she is the regional director of the World Health Organization's Africa region. And as Dr. John has mentioned, she will be talking to us about the acquisition of vaccines in Africa. Dr. Moeti, it's over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And a very good morning and good afternoon to all the journalists who've joined us in this press conference online. I'm very pleased to join my brother, Dr. John Kenasong, in this briefing. And I'd like to commend John for your leadership, for the intense and sustained action that you have put in place with your team to support African countries. It's absolutely unprecedented. And we are very, very pleased indeed to be working with you and your team. So in this briefing today, of course, John has already outlined the situation as far as the pandemic is concerned. And I'm going to say something to you about the ongoing efforts to step up vaccine acquisition, delivery, and rollout on the continent. As Dr. Nkengosong has said, the continent is still in the throes of the pandemic's third wave, although we've observed a slight slowdown in cases in the last 2 weeks. But we know that many things are happening daily, including we've just had the Eid celebrations that continue to fuel the spread of the virus. So we need to be monitoring these changes daily and monitoring these limited gains closely. We know that we're not out of the woods yet by any means. This has been the fastest rising surge, powered mainly by people's fatigue with COVID-19 preventive measures, with the presence of more transmissible variants, and the continent's very low. About 30 countries have used up more than 3/4 of the vaccines they received. Encouragingly, we're beginning to see positive signs as vaccine delivery to Africa are picking up pace after coming to a halt. So considering a two-dose schedule, as is the case with most of the vaccines available, 820 million vaccine doses are needed to reach the target of fully vaccinating 30% of Africa's population by the end of this year. In comparison, with only 245,000 doses that were supplied to just 6 countries in the whole of June, over the past week alone, 3.8 million vaccine doses were delivered to 13 countries through the COVAX facility, bringing the total doses delivered to the continent to 82 million. These recently delivered vaccines are part of 60 million doses that COVAX has allocated to 49 African countries to be shipped between now and September. Africa still needs more than 700 million doses to reach the 30% year-end target. And COVAX has also sealed deals with Sinopharm and Sinovac to supply 110 million doses for immediate supply to low-income countries, and out of these, 32.5 million are coming to Africa. These doses have been allocated to countries this week and will be delivered as soon as the countries are ready to receive them. With more vaccine candidates and manufacturing sites at the tail end of the review process for approval by WHO for emergency use listing, the COVAX facility is confident, or hopeful, let me say, that it will meet its end of the bargain to deliver at least 520 million doses to Africa by the end of 2021. We are really pleased and we commend the action of the African Union in also going out and seeking vaccines. And they have announced plans to start delivering the 400 million Johnson & Johnson doses that have been acquired and procured on behalf of African countries. This collective effort needs to include increased donations from high-income countries. We have very much appreciated the action of the U.S. government in providing millions of doses already through the COVAX and in agreement with the African Union that have completed. So we expect countries that have completed vaccination of most of their vulnerable populations to join the U.S. and to increase the doses that they are proposing to deliver and do that urgently. And also, very importantly, to release for purchase by COVAX and AVAT the reserved doses of vaccines that they have already prepaid with the manufacturers. In short, we promote very strongly the enlightened self-interest aimed at reducing the emergence of more variants for everyone by these countries donating and allowing the sale of the vaccines that they have already booked, so to speak. With the expected influx of vaccines, it is crucial that countries scale up all the aspects of vaccine rollout to reach as many people as possible. This entails mobilizing adequate resources, including finances for the vaccination activities, for logistics and the personnel, as well as addressing any concerns by communities, including those fueled by misinformation, to increase vaccine confidence and demand. We continue to support countries to better plan and cost vaccine operational and delivery processes. In the first phase of the rollout, countries were unable to lock out funding very often because costing plans often omitted critical expenses such as the cost of remuneration of vaccinators, administration, cold chain storage, logistics, and distribution at the subnational level of vaccines to the delivery points. Our experts have been on the ground since the onset of the pandemic, working with governments and partners to curb the virus by boosting key response measures, including through the testing, contact tracing, treatment, vaccine preparedness, rollout, and monitoring of any adverse events due to the vaccine. To date, WHO in the African region has deployed over 700 staff and consultants to support national authorities in the COVID-19 response. In addition, almost 1,300 of our staff have been repurposed to focus on pandemic control activities. African people, just like the rest of the world, are eager to see a return to normal life. But we must all do our part by getting vaccinated when the occasion is there for us, when the jabs are offered to us, and adhering to the preventive measures that have been so important in limiting transmission of the virus in Africa. I believe together we can begin to turn the tide against this untold human tragedy. And I look forward very much to our conversation today. And thank you once again for having joined us. Thank you, John, for having invited me to join. I hand over back to you, Madam Moderator.
Thank you very much, Dr. Matsidis Somaweti of the WHO, talking to us there about vaccine acquisition, as well as some of the response activities that are being undertaken by the WHO. Now it's time for us to move into our question and answer session, but let me just remind you of how you can send in your questions. So the first one is to use this WhatsApp number, +251 9455 02310. +251 9455 02310. Alternatively, you can come to us live or use the question and answer section. So let's move on to our first question for today, and it's coming from Kara Anna, who is with Associated Press. Kara says, thank you for this briefing. Now that Tanzania has started COVID-19 vaccinations and Burundi says it will accept the vaccines, that leaves only Eritrea. What reasons has Eritrea's government given for not pursuing vaccines? Dr. John, you will take that first question.
So thank you, Kara, for that question. We don't have a specific reason why Eritrea has not made a pronounced itself on that, but we continue to hope that the situation will change and we'll continue to engage them. As I just mentioned, I just came back from the Tanzania last night and had a very good conversation with the leadership of that country, the new leadership, and the president herself, President Excellency Samia Hassan, was very supportive, and we spoke about the COVID pandemic very openly and very freely. And before I left yesterday, I was delighted to see that she has taken her vaccine, and we are committed to working with them to rolling out the 1 million doses of vaccines that they just received from as part of the U.S. Supply. So we are very encouraged. The Minister of Health was extremely supportive, and we look forward to doing our little best to support that effort. Similarly, in Burundi, we will continue to engage with Burundi And in the coming weeks, of course, we will be intensifying our efforts there to understand the gaps and areas where we can support them, and similarly with Eritrea. So again, just to conclude, my answer on that question is that the concept and philosophy at the African Union is that we leave no country behind, because we are not going to win this battle against COVID-19 on our continent if any country is left behind. So we take that very seriously, and we will keep you updated as we make any significant engagements with any of these countries.
Thank you very much. Let's go to colleagues coming online. And the first one today is Daniel Arap Moi. Good morning, Daniel. Please tell us your news agency and ask your question, as well as tell us who it is directed at. Over to you, Daniel.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Daniel Arap Moi from CGTN Africa, based in Nairobi. My question goes to Dr. Moeti, the first question, and the second question I'll forward to CDC. To Dr. Moeti, researchers are now raising concerns over cases of individuals who are testing positive for coronavirus despite being fully vaccinated. Now, this then raises the question, how protected is someone who has already been fully vaccinated against COVID-19? And how rampant are cases of breakthroughs in Africa?
Dr. Moeti.
Okay, thank you. That's a good question and an active concern in many countries today. I think that it has been known that the vaccines will not altogether prevent transmission. I think some of the ones with the highest efficacy, like Pfizer, BioNTech, cause people not to have very low viral loads after being fully vaccinated, meaning that their ability to transmit the virus to others is limited. But what we have understood is the main benefit of these vaccines, of all the vaccines, is preventing people getting severe forms of the illness such that they need intensive care, and preventing people from dying. So it seems also that the Delta variant, which is becoming predominant now virtually all over the world, which is certainly circulating in over 25 countries in Africa, we believe, is more transmissible, and is more transmissible even among people who have been fully vaccinated. So I think people need to understand that we take the vaccine, of course, to reduce the rate of transmission of the virus, but also very much to reduce severe illness and to reduce death. As you are aware, there is a debate going on now, and I believe that the American government is about to issue guidance on the use of masks by people who have been fully vaccinated in the context of this highly transmissible Delta variant, which is circulating in many, many countries. So what I would say to people is that do take the vaccine. It will reduce your chances of being infected. It will not eliminate them altogether. But we have seen there are very few deaths among people who have been fully vaccinated, and there are very few severe cases of this form of illness among people who are fully vaccinated. And that is a huge benefit already in terms of our objectives in the vaccination.
Thank you very much, Dr. Moeti. I think we can now move on to Judith Akolo, who is with the Kenya Broadcasting Corporation. And she says, I would like to ask Dr. John Nkengasong, is Kenya also experiencing its fourth wave like Tunisia and Nigeria? Because yesterday, Kenya registered 1,006 new infections from a sample size of 5,584. And an infection rate of 18%. What determines a new wave? Is it the infection rate or the death rate? Dr. John.
So, thank you. I have not, I've been traveling the last couple of days, so I've not looked at the data country by country as I usually do. And tomorrow will be that day where we look at the entire spectrum of where we each country is, and I'll be able to look at Kenya more closely to see where how their daily, the 7 days moving average is where it's trending towards. So, I mean, we look at the 7 days moving average and to look at and make a determination if they continue to bend the curve or the curve has flattened and that is ticking up. So that is at that point that we raise an alarm that the country might be moving towards a subsequent wave. So I think that is, at this point, Judith, I cannot tell you if, based on the information that I have, that Kenya is actually moving into the fourth wave or not. But that information should be made available hopefully next week when we have this discussion.
Thank you for that. The next one is for Dr. Moeti, and it's coming from Bonisile Makubu from the Times of Eswatini. She says countries like Eswatini are seeing high numbers of new infections among the 0 to 19-year age group. Considering this, what would you advise on the opening up of schools?
Okay, thank you very much. You know, all countries are facing this dilemma between letting life go back to normal and really covering some of the gaps that have been imposed by the lockdowns in all spheres of life, economy, education very much, which is a big concern, and other socioeconomic activities against the risk of worsening the situation in terms of transmission. Certainly, if young people are going to be going back to school, which is a very important objective, then there needs to be a lot of investment in ensuring that this does not result in super spreader events within the classroom and children taking the infection back home where they are likely to infect adults who may be vulnerable to falling seriously ill and dying. I think that is the logic. So each country needs to look at its own situation. What is the rate of increase of cases? And I think that Eswatini is among the countries that have been among those experiencing what we call resurgence. So there needs to be a lot of caution applied to whether the prevention measures, the distancing, the wearing of masks can be put in place effectively in Eswatini so that we don't have young people who are at school being the source of infection to those who are more vulnerable before the vaccination of older people who may be vulnerable, who are vulnerable to more serious illnesses can take place. So it is a balancing act and the government needs to weigh this up very carefully. And I would say that, of course, we would like children to go back to school. We want girls especially to go back to school so to minimize the risk of children dropping out forever, which is a huge risk in the current situation. But we certainly would advise against doing this without putting in place the proper prevention measures to ensure that this does not worsen the overall situation in the country. And we know the measures to take to put in place to ensure this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Moeti. Sophie Mukwena is online, and Sophie is with the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Good morning, Sophie. Please go ahead with your question and just tell us who it is directed at.
My question is directed at both Dr. Moeti and Dr. Kengasong. The issue of the third wave, taking for example South Africa, we were experiencing a third wave, and last week the president took a decision to relax measures that were intended to fight this third wave. Is it too early? Because yesterday the numbers that were reported were very high. But secondly, much as there was decline in positive cases, the death toll is much higher than the first wave and the second wave. What could be the disjuncture? And also the recent unrest and gathering in South Africa, at what point are we likely to see the implication and the impact thereof on rising numbers and death toll? And yeah, are we going to really have a break before we go to the fourth wave?
All right, thank you very much, Sophie. Dr. Moeti?
Yes, thank you. I mean, again, a question of balancing between the situation of the pandemic, the severity of the third wave, and indeed there is a third wave in South Africa, which has been also spreading to the sub-region because of the close links between South Africa and neighboring countries, and the need to reopen the economy. I think the situation in South Africa, you mentioned the recent unrest, looting, etc., which I think we need to acknowledge may have been triggered by particular events, but had as part of the background the severe economic impact on low-income people of the COVID-19 pandemic, including some of the measures like the lockdowns that needed to be imposed. And I think the government had to balance that against what was emerging as a slowing down of the pandemic. There had already been a decrease in the number of daily cases. So it, again, was having to see the measures of opening up, taking into account the severe economic impact, and reinforcing the prevention measures at the same time as loosening up some of the lockdown measures. What I do know is that what was opened up was, for example, inter-provincial travel now. The curfew remains, but perhaps is later, and then restaurants have been allowed to open, and the sale of alcohol is allowed. I think that the country now has gained experience in monitoring how things are going. Clearly, we may be expecting to see, following this reduction in cases, an increase in the cases where some of the worst gathering, when the looting was happening, occurred. This should be starting to show very soon. But I believe that before this decision was taken, the government must have taken a very detailed look at the trends, at the measures, at the available resources for ensuring these measures are implemented. And we know that they are able to monitor the situation and adjust. They've had experience now in readjusting these measures closely. So your question is very valid. I'm certain it's being analyzed on a day-to-day basis. And if the trend seems to be going back up again in a sustained way, I'm certain the government will take the right decision then. It's very much a balancing act for all countries.
Thank you. Dr. John, do you have a comment on that question?
No, I think, I mean, Dr. Moeti very nicely laid out the explanation. It's a balancing act. I mean, the government is faced with a choice of saving lives and saving livelihoods, and that is a situation that will only be addressed once we roll out vaccines in a significant way. And South Africa has one of the best public health experts that I can think of, and they do analyze the data very regularly. And I was in South Africa just 5 weeks ago, met with the ministry, met with researchers from CAPRISA, and very impressed with the way they are looking at triangulating data to use that to guide the response. I absolutely have no doubt that they know what they are doing, and this is the third time they are bending the curve. And let me just say that the 15% decrease that I just mentioned, when you look at last week compared to this week, is largely due to what is happening in South Africa. So I think that South Africa has become, just like Kenya, they've become veterans in bending their curve down and relieving their health system. The people always ask me the question, which are the countries in Africa that have done better than others? That's where most countries in Africa have done very remarkably well. Nigeria, South Africa, Kenya. Because if they were not doing that, you probably would see an escalated situation where it will be completely, the health system will be completely overwhelmed. So if you plot those graphs there, you see nice peaks. They come down, they go up, they come down. It's because of the balancing act that Dr. Moeti mentioned between saving our economies and saving lives there. So you continue to see that, Sophie, until we are at a steady state where vaccines would have been introduced and everybody can actually begin to, life can actually begin to return to normal.
All right. Thank you very much, both. Let's move on now to Hilary Olwinde from Agence France-Presse. The Burundi Health Minister, Dr. Ndikumana, yesterday said they are ready to accept the COVAX vaccines from the World Bank. However, the country has refused to sign forms asking for commitment to reimburse or manage the side effects linked to the vaccines. What do both the Africa CDC and the WHO have to say on the issue? So I will give that to Dr. John, and then we will move on to other questions because we have quite a number coming in. Dr. John, over to you.
Wonderful. Tomorrow we have a meeting with all ministers of finance and ministers of health and the World Bank and the AVAT team, that is the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team. And I'm very encouraged that Burundi will be part of that and that discussion and dialogue on how to acquire these vaccines and roll them out. We stand ready, just to put it very briefly, to work with Burundi to provide them with the technical assistance so that they can deploy the vaccines in all dimensions and not just look at the immunization, but also monitor the effect of the vaccines going forward. I haven't seen that statement from the Minister of Health, so it is difficult to comment with specifics as to what the Minister is referring to.
All right, thank you. Let's say good morning to Girum Chala. Girum, good morning, and please go ahead with your question. Just tell us who the question is directed at.
Thank you so much, Madam. Girum Chala, CGT, and based at the African Union headquarters. Dr. John, good to hear from you, and Dr. from WHO as well. My question is one, and it's for both of you. Why don't we talk about the economy of Africa? I also want to take you back of your plan of saving lives, economies, and livelihoods. What is really happening? Are you talking to the respective departments at the Commission, for instance, the Economy Department, Agriculture Department, and the others? Because COVID-19 is still making people's lives difficult. Economies are going down. Some of the economies are unable to recover. So what is really happening? How is the world going to support Africa? And if there is any progress in this regard, can you please share with us? Thank you.
All right. So I think you've spoken there about the African Union. So let me give that to Dr. John first.
Yes, I think that is a very good question. I think our briefings tend to focus on the health component. But there's a lot going on that is not being put out there, or is put out there through different channels by the African Union and the UN Commission for Africa, Economic Commission for Africa, that is headed by Dr. Vera Songwe. And I'm sure if they do briefings, you hear a lot there. So from what, and we work very closely, we, the Africa CDC, work very closely with all of these, the commission and the Commissioner Amani, Commissioner Muchanga, and others. And from what I know is that there's a lot of intense work going on with to engage with the World Bank and the IMF on the special drain rights that will make money more available to countries to stimulate economies. If you recall, Jerome, so many developed worlds have poured in trillions and trillions of dollars, and that has not been the case with many African countries. So I think these special drain rights and other mechanisms that our economy, the AU special invoices, that were put in place by the President Ramaphosa, who is still a COVID champion, but at that time, last year, he was the chair of the African Union. I was still working tirelessly to unblock some of these economic measures. I think that is, so the saving lives, livelihood, and economy is still so much alive. I think we will continue to work with member states to implement the trusted travel, because that is also part of another dimension that is impacting our ability to move. And if it impacts ability to move, it impacts our economy. I think there's a lot going on in the economy front, which is not usually reported during these press briefings.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Moeti. Do you have a very brief comment to make on that before we move on to the next question?
Yes, I think I'll agree with Dr. Santiago. So, and just add, of course, there's been a lot of discussion about rescheduling debt payment. Many African countries have high rates of debt to international financing institutions, and that's part of that support. I mean, I can only add that making vaccines rapidly available to African people to be deployed urgently would be one very good contribution to fastening or speeding up the reopening of African economies so that people at the lowest level can go out and earn their livelihoods. So if we can say anything to the economic community, indeed the financing is very important, the debt rescheduling is very important, and providing African people with vaccines is one important way also to support the economic recovery sooner rather than later.
Thank you very much for that. Elizabeth Merab, who is with The Nation in Nairobi, Kenya, says there have been reports of adverse effects following immunization, AEFI, among women regarding interrupted menstrual cycles, as well as diagnosis of clots in people who are young and did not have clots before. Have you heard of these AEFIs and what's being done about it? That's for you, Dr. Moeti.
Okay, thank you very much. We are monitoring with our WHO country teams in on the ground and our group that's working on vaccines, the AEFIs that are documented in countries. What we've observed with the data that we've had so far, which admittedly is not complete, is that there have been relatively few reports of severe adverse effects among the people in the region so far. We recognize this surveillance, if you like, of AEFI needs to be strengthened, but we have largely received from these data collection systems indications of the milder AEFIs. Of course, what we are doing as well with our teams that work on case management is to sensitize the treatment side of this, sensitize the population of the type of symptoms that must make them report immediately to a health facility to prevent these severe AEFIs resulting in a loss of life. So that's something that we're very much working on. But so far, we have not had reports from the surveillance system that's in place of many cases of these severe AEFIs. But certainly they're taken into account in the process of both monitoring from the vaccinated and case management and sensitization of populations that are vaccinated.
Thank you very much. The next question is for Dr. John, and it's coming from Alex Winning from Reuters, the news agency. When the African Union and AVAT announced the Johnson & Johnson deal, it was said that 220 million doses had been secured, with an option for a further 180 million. Could you confirm that the 180 million option has now been taken up? How is that option being funded, given that Afreximbank's facility only covered the first 220 million doses? And also, could you say how many of the 400 million doses will be delivered in this year of 2021?
Thank you. Very, very good question. Let me start at a very high level. Very good, remarkable progress has been made with respect to acquiring the 220 million doses of vaccines and then even moving into the 400 million doses of vaccines. Through the efforts and partnership with the World Bank, it is very possible that we will exhaust those 400 million doses of vaccine, because many more countries have now, through this, the support and partnership of the World Bank, come into the fold to acquire additional vaccines there. So we are very pleased with where we are at this point with respect to those vaccines. As I indicated earlier, the distribution of those vaccines will start next week. And as we speak, communiques are being written to countries and engagement. We'll be working with UNICEF that will be mainly distributing the vaccines on behalf of the AVAT. So we anticipate that the first couple of 8 million vaccines will begin to roll out in the coming days to member states. Then come September and October, the number of doses will escalate. I cannot give you, I don't have the specifics of how many vaccines will roll out in September and how many will roll out in August and November. But all of that information can be made available, and I can promise you that we'll bring that information to you next week. I thought last week that Mr. Masiwa, who is coordinating the effort. I actually expanded on that. So that's why I didn't pay attention this week to capture those numbers. But it is exciting. One of the things that I just spent the whole morning today doing was working on the communication and engagement with countries to alert them that these vaccines were coming. I can't believe we are discussing when the delivery of those vaccines will occur. It almost seemed like an eternity that at the start of the year we're discussing the prospects of signing the contracts and getting the vaccines and getting to 220 million. And today we are discussing when the delivery will occur. So I'm very, very encouraged and remain hopeful. As I always said, we celebrate every little move during this pandemic because it will contribute to victory, overall victory, to winning the war against the pandemic.
Thank you very much. Let's move on to a question which I'll throw to Dr. Moeti, and it's coming from Sarah Jerving, who is with DevEx. She says, as countries, as the vaccines come into countries, are there concerns about the absorptive capacity of these vaccines? Are COVAX allocations determined by the absorptive capacity of countries, and what sort of expiry dates do you anticipate the COVAX doses to have?
Thank you. That's a very important question of the moment, as the prospects for vaccine delivery, as I said in my statement, start to improve. When COVAX distributes or allocates vaccines, I think the primary determination is to ensure equity among countries based on agreements that have been reached on them. That's a kind of core principle of the COVAX. And then, of course, there's also a look at what countries have been able to absorb before being practical. We want to minimize countries having to redistribute vaccines that have been deployed to them, because that, frankly, spends more time and energy, which could be used in the rollout of the vaccines themselves. Countries have done a lot of thinking and micro-planning to prepare for receiving the vaccines, and we have worked with partners like UNICEF and others to support this process. They've learned a lot as well from the first round of delivering doses of vaccines about some of the issues that I mentioned before, being as meticulous as possible about mobilizing additional capacity of people who will actually deliver the vaccines, vaccination sites, registering people who are going to be vaccinated, and then the logistics, supply chain, and even the financial resources, making sure that money reaches the people who have to deliver the vaccine and doesn't stay in the capital cities, as sometimes happens when we run campaigns. We are looking, and I don't have the details here, at expiry dates of some of the vaccines that are going to be delivered. We are particularly concerned that some of the donations may have very short timelines in terms of expiry dates, and this is something that needs our careful monitoring always. What we do is ensure that the countries have this information as they're receiving the vaccine, so that they structure the delivery in order to minimize vaccines reaching their expiry date before they are used. So this is something that we're very much aware of in our work with countries. But as Dr. Nkengasong was saying, we are now at this very encouraging phase after a bleak June of vaccines becoming available. We're working very hard to make sure that the capacity is ramped up, the partners provide the support so that every single dose can be translated into a person vaccinated.
Thank you for that. We have questions coming from...
Dr. Moeti touched on the donations, that we, of course, are extremely grateful for all the donations that are coming in to the continent, be it through COVAX or AVAG or bilaterally. We really appealed for anyone donating vaccines to the continent that they should be mindful of the expiring dates. And that way we do not end up with another issue and a different narrative on the continent that vaccines have been donated and they were not used, and because of the expiring date. If the vaccines come with very short expiring date, it will be difficult to for the countries to absorb that. And then the narrative will be that the continent didn't use vaccines. I think we should avoid that kind of a narrative and make sure that we coordinate our efforts as much as possible, keep the communication lines open, and only make sure that we donate vaccines that will have at least a 3 month to 4 month shelf life. I think that is very important. Otherwise, we'll very easily find ourselves into a very confusing scenario where the narrative can easily be misleading.
Thank you both. We now move on to questions from Paul Adepoju, who is with the journal Nature and Health Policy Watch. So he says, Pfizer data has suggested a third dose to boost protection against the Delta variant. Will the World Health Organization and the Africa CDC advocate for this? Dr. Moeti and Dr. John, what do you consider to be the biggest challenge for the massive rollout of COVID-19 vaccines, and how can the countries overcome these challenges? So let me start with Dr. John.
So as the, in my view, the and the, Afri, the views of Africa CDC that is that we can get this done, okay, as a continent, if and only if we have a predictable supply of vaccines. That is why I go back to my earlier comment about the need for all these donations to be coordinated so that we know exactly which vaccine you are going to get, a country is going to get, and then you can plan with them. Then we also know about how do we engage the community and make sure that the community is part and parcel of this vaccination exercise. Vaccines are different. If a country is receiving the Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, it's very different from if they are receiving the AstraZeneca or the Johnson & Johnson. So they need to prepare in function of that. And if we have to conduct a massive campaign, we...
Welcome back. And we were just listening to... excerpts from the Africa CDC briefing from July 29th, 2021. And that was led by the Director General of the African Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. John Nkengasong. And also joining him was the Regional Director for the World Health Organization for Southern Africa, and that is Sibiso Wetchi. And this is the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. And, of course, we're here every week bringing you coverage and analysis of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. And, of course, this is a program that is heavily concerned about the conditions on the African, throughout the African diaspora and the international community, indeed. And this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and we'll take a break, and we'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Music there in your eyes. take a magic carpet ride. Yes, we will. And we'll tell our smoky friends, hey, don't you forget, because you got to keep us side by side.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, Worldwide Radio Broadcast, and it is the early morning first hour of August 1st, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And we want to now turn to the developments that occurred in the Elaine, Arkansas, in Phillips County, Arkansas, in 1919, a year of racial turmoil and massacres. 1921, of course, was commemorated just earlier this year in regard to developments in Tulsa, Oklahoma. This is 2 years before where there were race massacres in Chicago and Washington, D.C., and also in Phillips County, Arkansas, in Elaine, Arkansas. Let's listen to this documentary on those developments from 1919.
It happened 100 years ago, an event that stained Arkansas but altered the course of American law. It may well have been the worst, deadliest episode of racial violence in the nation's history. To this day, we cannot know for sure how many people were killed, only that the vast majority were black, and that a dozen men who almost certainly would have died were spared only through an heroic and dangerous quest for justice. The Massacre at Elaine, a special edition of Arkansas Week, coming up.
Support for Arkansas Week provided by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the Arkansas Times, and KUAR-FM 89.
Hello again, everyone, and thank you for joining us. The basics are these. On the night of September 29, 1919, a group of African-American tenant farmers gathered near Elaine in Phillips County to discuss how they could obtain fairness from the landowners. Two white men watching the meeting were shot and one died. Over the next 3 days, by some estimates, more than 200 black Arkansans were slaughtered in white mob violence, and five whites were killed as well. Federal troops were needed to end the chaos. No whites were arrested, but more than 100 African Americans were accused, and a dozen were put on trial for their lives.
Because white men have been killed, more black men must die. Hundreds are detained, 67 are sent to prison, and 12 are tried by an all-white jury for the murder of whites. As the trial begins, a mob surrounds the court building, warning the court that if the accused are not sentenced to death, the mob will lynch them.
That's an excerpt from a Rockefeller Foundation documentary on what we know as the Elaine Massacre. There's no denying, no erasing what happened in Phillips County 100 years ago, and only in the past few years has the scope of the horror become evident. To acknowledge what happened at Elaine is anything but the complete accounting the victims and history deserve, though that work continues, perhaps in small measure, over the next half hour. No journalist, no scholar has done, no one has done more to document the events of a century ago than Griff Stockley, attorney, activist, author of a history of the riots and their aftermath. Dr. Brian Mitchell is an assistant professor of history at the University of Arkansas Little Rock, whose specialties include African American history, and who has uncovered some new aspects to the Elaine tragedy. And Dr. Kyle Miller is director of the Delta Cultural Center at Helena, West Helena. He is a descendant of four of the Elaine victims. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here.
Good. Griff, let's start with you.
Well,
where to begin?
Well, I'm going to pass that to the most accomplished scholar we've got now, and I'd like to let him give you this background, and then I'll chip in, and maybe Kyle can too. But Brian has done the most recent research available, and with your permission, I'd like for him to kind of start the story.
Permission granted, Doctor.
I'd like to begin the story of the Elaine Massacre several years before the massacre itself. To understand what was going on in Elaine, first you have to understand sharecropping and the nature of sharecropping. Sharecropping was instituted to revert the newly emancipated freedmen back into slavery. And under that system, they were supposed to share a portion of the crops with their landlords. Unfortunately, the landlords often cheated them out of their shares and gave them very high rates of interest at the plantation stores. This kept them perpetually in debt and unable to leave the plantations.
Slavery by another name, in other words.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. Let's pick up, though, Griff, if I can come back to you. I'm going to let you off the hook so easily. We ought to note that it was the efforts of an early African-American attorney in Little Rock, Arkansas, who stepped in and began the long legal process of sparing those 12 individuals from the electric chair.
And of course, you're talking about Scipio Africanus Jones, who is really one of the most amazing attorneys ever to come out of Arkansas, and I don't think he's gotten enough attention or credit for all the work he did and the courage that he showed. But it wasn't just that. He was someone who was not slick, but he knew how to work the system. And it was through much of his talent and skill and willingness to even compromise that got us to the point to, where these men could be spared. Would y'all agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Most definitely.
Right. He undertook this defense, this case, under threat of his life.
He did, and
he was assisted, but I...
Right, and it's important to the story to recognize the other attorneys involved, but at the very end, it seemed like Scipio Jones was there in a way that almost no other attorneys would risk their own reputation, risk so much of their goodwill, but he came out smelling like a rose historically.
Yeah. Dr. Miller, just the basic, again, to hit the basics of what happened that night and in the subsequent days.
Well,
you know, so basically, as the story is told, you had tenant farmers who were basically, they were wanting to negotiate for more wages, and they were having a meeting at the church in Hoopspur, and they were looking for fair wages. And while they were having their meeting, that meeting was disrupted, and through there was crossfire, and that's where you had the ensuing of violence that began to take place.
Their objective was basically a threat to the entire system that prevailed in the Delta.
Absolutely, and Brian could definitely tell you a lot more about that. But Brian, I think in some of the talks I heard, wasn't cotton at that time like around $30 per pound?
Cotton was at an all-time high. It wasn't $30.
Oh, was it not? $30 per pound.
It was at an all-time high, and most of the sharecroppers had been at this type of work their entire lives. They knew what a bale of cotton was. They knew the value of a bale. They were looking forward to handsome shares. But then when they realized that they were not going to be paid according to their negotiations, their previous negotiations, they decided to hire an attorney. What we now know that we didn't when Blood in Their Eyes was first written was that the planners, the business elite, were all very aware of what was going on. They had plants and spies within the union, and these plants and spies came back to them with messages and letting them know who exactly was there at the meetings and what was being said. We believe that the police that were outside of the Hoopspur Church quite possibly were there because they were sent there to intimidate the union people into giving up their fight for fair wages.
And from that night forward, for the next, 3 days, there was absolute, it was a reign of terror followed.
Yeah. Most definitely. I think one of the things that we tend to overlook when we analyze this story is that the way people were intimidated was just one of a whole series of ways we implemented white supremacy. I mean, you can't think of this story without realizing that this was just one of the ways. And again, with your permission, I'd like to just enumerate the way that this was done, the way we implemented white supremacy. And I grew up in an era where, you know, my family was part of it. But as LC and his wife, Daisy Bates, knew only too well, white supremacy had been carried out by slavery, bad science, murder, rape, terrorism, lynching, massacres, mass incarceration, peonage, disfranchisement, racial cleansing, arson, racial covenants, predatory lending, loan discrimination, redlining, blockbusting, segregation, intimidation, humiliation, discrimination, denial of free speech, termination from employment, a truly massive theft of financial resources for services lawfully intended for black citizens, quarantine rather than effective treatment of black persons diagnosed with tuberculosis, paternalism, and a civil and criminal justice system that routinely denied African Americans due process and equal protection of the law. As an integral part, part of impediments to African American rights, the official and unofficial writing of the South's racial past sometimes resembled propaganda rather than history in order to justify the actions of white Southerners. Notwithstanding the carnage and devastation caused by the Civil War, accounts of the South's struggle and its defeat over time have often been transformed into an occasion for nostalgia, reenactments, and legends rather than attempts to come to terms with its actual history. I'm curious if y'all agree with that.
Hard to disagree with that.
What book are you quoting there?
Well, this is... I want to tell you, it's my most recent book that came out in 2017. It's Black Boys Burning, the 1959 Fire at the Arkansas Negro Boys Industrial School. All of us are really acquainted more intimately than we like to admit with what we have done.
If there was a single, maybe a single incident, even with all due respect to the 57 crisis, if there was anything that would give the lie to the what some people have called, what I would call, the Margaret Mitchellization of post-Civil War America, it would be the Elaine episode. Dr. Miller?
I totally would agree with that. Even coming from the standpoint of my family, who I guess some might say, I've heard some people refer to us as being more affluent or a wealthy family, but still being a victim of it as well, because even in those events, my great uncles were totally oblivious to what was going on in the events in Elaine on an annual hunting trip, and were given the advice as they were coming through Elaine, hey, you probably don't want to go in there. They ditched their vehicle and plans of catching a train, hoping they can get through to Helena and get pulled off the train, and are brutally murdered and dumped in a ditch. So, yeah, it's just a horrible, horrible event.
Documentation and not merely anecdotal accounts, memories, Dr. Mitchell made clear that among the dead were not even near the church that night, or were not even actively engaged in the movement.
Well, we now know from a number of records, the American Legion Post minutes, the New Orleans State's item, officer by the name of James, picking up Ed Ware, who had taken flight and was living under an alias in New Orleans, identifies that most of the men in the Union were captured the morning following the shooting at Hoop Spur. So what occurs after that, the violence that occurs after that.
Hoop Spur was a little community near Elaine, right?
Right.
Okay.
What occurs after the Hoop Spur shooting has nothing to do with the Union. It is just the community's response to this notion that there is an insurrection or a revolution afoot.
It seems almost trite to ask or to pose the question, what are the lessons of Elaine today? How is what happened a century ago in East Arkansas applicable to Arkansas today, to America today?
Directly applicable. First off, we're more polarized than I've ever seen the nation in my lifetime, and my mother's still alive in her lifetime. This is a response of fear that the community has. It only took a spark, a little spark of one person saying that this was an insurrection, to not only have neighbors come out and kill neighbors, but have people pour in from other states and have the federal government send troops. Right now, it's only going to take a spark for something to ignite as we approach the election. And one of the lessons that we can learn from this is that calmer minds must always prevail, that we must look at ourselves as American citizens first.
And you know, there's been a lot of discussion and debate about what's the relevance and the significance of a monument, you know, to recognize the Elaine Massacre, because some people say, you know, it was a violent time in history, and we really just need to forget it and forget about it. But monuments are important because they cause us to remember the past, and I think it's important to remember so that we don't repeat it. And so I think that with us moving and having a monument, which we're planning to have the monument opening on Sunday, is an important first step, because prior to then, as a lot of people in Arkansas know, nobody would even talk about it. And so to go from people in our community not even talking about it to now having a monument, to me is to be a pun that's monumental. I think it's monumental.
Yeah. Griffin, everyone, I don't want to leave hanging the fate of those 12 men who were eventually spared. Mm-hmm. But they were in peril of their lives. This involved, they were granted relief at one stage or another by a variety of courts, and it went all the way up to Washington, D.C., the nation's highest court. Who wants to pick up the story from the indictment?
Well, you're the lawyer. Go ahead.
People are always saying, well, you're the lawyer. I mean, it's a very complicated...
Well, you took the bar, Stockley.
Somehow they said I passed it. No, seriously, it is a complex series of cases that did reach the Supreme Court, and but there's six of the defendants ended up being released.
They divided. They decided to divide the cases into two groups. One group was called the Moore Group, and it was led by Frank Moore. He was one of the leaders in the union, and the Farmers Union. The other group was the Ware Group. The Supreme Court case, the one that actually gets to the Supreme Court case and forces the release of the men, is the Moore case. The Moore case gets there, and what is discovered is that these men had been subjected to torture to elicit their responses of guilt. And moreover, it was determined that the men could not have gotten a fair trial. The mobs outside of the jail were demanding blood. Many of the members of the American Legion that had participated as part of the posse were on the investigative committee. They had a standing committee within the organization to put pressure on the governor to make sure that these men were executed. And the Supreme Court determined that it was impossible for these individuals to have received a fair trial.
What is significant, I think, about these cases, when you take them as a whole, is that for the first time, due process was considered to be paramount in the interest of all of us. And that's kind of what we have not, or we've gotten away from, is looking at justice in a broader sense and applying it to what we've done in race relations. So, I mean, these are of monumental importance.
Right, absolutely.
Now, but I think, Dr. Mutchie, you've done some additional research after Elaine, after acquittal, after they were released.
Right.
You've uncovered some new history.
Yes, we do have a public history program at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and one of the things that we've been trying to get our graduate students to do is engage the community in community-based history. To do this, one of the projects we set out to do last fall was to try to write bios for all of these men, figuring out what happened to them after they were released from prison. Most of them went up north. They escaped Arkansas completely, and we were able to piece together their lives. Many of them worked in Chicago, in St. Louis, in Ohio, and in Kansas, mostly labor jobs in the city. And many of them are buried around the nation, and what our goal has been is to erect markers at the grave sites of all of those men and to make sure that all of them have headstones that identify them and tell the nation about what they've done.
You used the term, Dr. Mitchell, a second ago, they escaped Arkansas. suggesting that it wasn't merely economic. This was before the great Black Northern migration,
right.
The industrial migration. It wasn't just economic opportunity that drew them or that prompted them to leave the state. It was physical safety.
Well, scholars are reassessing that whole narrative. I know when you and I were growing up, we were always told about the Great Migration, and we were always told that the Great Migration was started because of all of the opportunity in the North and in the West. But what we're learning as scholars is that racial violence, white supremacy, intimidation, all play a significant role in that migration and getting people, forcing people to move out of the Delta. One of the more fascinating artifacts that we found was an article in the Topeka Plains Dealer. And it appears in the 1920 Plains Dealer, I believe. The article notes that 200 indigent people, so that people just picked up and left Phillips County after the massacre, and they show up in Topeka, Arkansas, believing because Robert Lee Hill, the founder of the Union, was given sanctuary there, that that is an ideal place for them to settle. So imagine leaving penniless, your crops in the ground, nothing but what you can hold, and making your way to Topeka and trying to refashion a life for yourself and your family. That decision wasn't an economic decision. That decision was totally based on their fear of what could happen to them in the Delta.
Doctor, at the center, how much of this are you documenting? What could a visitor come to your center and see, touch, read, hear?
Well, we have lots of archives at the Delta Cultural Center dealing with the Elaine Massacre. We're also, along with our sister museum, Mosaics, have an exhibit that deals with the Elaine Massacre. And we're also in the process of putting together a larger exhibit that will speak to the massacre.
Right. Griff Stockley, we're about out of time, but I'll give you the final word. You can close for your clients here.
Well, I think we all ought to recognize how important the work that is being done, and I frankly don't think enough attention has been given, and we're delighted, you know, with this show and others to let people know what is happening in the area of research and the kind of work that has been done. I mean, I'm optimistic about much of this because of the quality of the work that's been done, and we've got something to be proud of, I think.
Griff Stockley, Dr. Mitchell, Dr. Miller, thank you very much for being part of our program.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for watching. We'll see you next week.
Support for Arkansas Week provided by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, the Arkansas Times, and KUAR-FM 89.
Welcome back, and this is the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio broadcast for early Sunday morning, August 1st, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. That was an examination of the 1919 race massacre in Phillips County, Arkansas, right outside of Elaine, Arkansas. And right now we're going to examine another similar incident that occurred just northeast of the Delta region of Arkansas, and that was in Knoxville, Tennessee, the race terror of 1919 at Knoxville. Let's listen in.
Knoxville had been growing really since 1870. After the Civil War, freed slaves had come in from the countryside looking for a new life. So had rural whites. There's a post-war population explosion. And Knoxville takes off briefly as a poster child for the New South. And for some of these whites coming in, it's the first time they've ever worked beside a black person. They're living, some of them almost side by side. And there's a lot of conflict going on. Even though the city leadership tries to turn a blind eye to it, it's there. And as a matter of fact, there had been a study done by a University of Tennessee graduate student in 1919 in which she predicted that these conditions will lead to some sort of racial violence if something isn't done.
Knoxville was a staged city where race relations were pretty good. Black people knew their place and stayed in it. And I think we had a white paternalistic society that left black people to their own devices as long as they didn't create a lot of trouble. To me, it was interesting how the local newspapers described the black community. For example, the corner Vine and Central was a place where there were a number of black establishments, whether they were grocery stores or taxicab companies or shoeshine parlors. That area was described as Little Harlem. And of course, that's kind of a compliment because Harlem was a very thriving place in New York City, and to be compared to that, I think had to be received as a compliment. Well, 1919 was a very volatile year all across the country. It was certainly just after the end of World War I, and there were a number of black men coming back to this country having fought overseas, and they were coming back into a racial situation that they just couldn't appreciate because they had had some measure of freedom and dignity overseas, but had to come back to this country and suffer from racial indignities. And consequently, there were a number of race riots throughout the country. My memory tells me that there were at least 25 of them across the United States. And James Weldon Johnson, who was head of the NAACP, termed it the Red Summer, because in many cases, some of the streets literally ran with red with blood.
In addition to the racial and labor tensions that are going on nationwide, there was a great deal of political tension. The mayor, John E. McMillan, was up for re-election. One of the reasons that the mayor was controversial at that time was his progressive attitude towards race relations. He had been elected largely with black votes. He had made an address to the black business leaders denouncing the riots elsewhere, he had denounced lynching, and had said that he personally intended to make sure that nothing like that could ever happen in Knoxville. There had been threats against black voters, warnings that black voters should stay home on election day. Threatening posters had been posted around town. The mayor had a lot of black campaign workers, one of them being Maurice Mays. Maurice Mays had spent that entire day campaigning for the mayor, handing out campaign flyers and poll tax receipts. In those days, Tennessee has a poll tax. You have to pay the poll tax in order to vote. But if someone pays the poll tax for you and you have a receipt, that's perfectly fine. And he had been handing out poll tax receipts all day to black voters with the understanding that they would vote for John E. McMillan. Maurice Mays was rumored to be the illegitimate son of the mayor, John E. McMillan. And according to members of McMillan's family, it was acknowledged as true. His mother had been a young maid who left Knoxville shortly after his birth. He was about 6 months old when he was adopted by William and Frances Mays.
Maurice Mays was a black fellow who was very handsome, who liked white women, and white women liked him, and certainly 1919 was not the year to have these kinds of relationships. So there was a police officer in Knoxville who knew about Mays's activities and had warned him about dating white women and threatened to put him in the penitentiary if he were ever to catch him. and to do other terrible things to him if he caught him. A white woman by the name of Bertie Lindsay wound up murdered.
The 27-year-old Bertie Lindsay was born Bertie Smith in Lee County, Virginia. In 1916, she married Daniel P. Lindsay, a carpenter from Dandridge, Tennessee, and worked at the Standard Knitting Mill. Her bedroom assault and murder at 1612 8th Avenue in North Knoxville was witnessed by her younger cousin, Ora Smith.
Well, the policeman who hated Mays was investigating the case, and he said, "I know exactly who that murderer was." So they went to Mays's house and rousted him out of bed and took him to the scene of the crime, put him under a dimly lit street lamp, and the woman identified him as the murderer. This woman had been sleeping in the bed with her cousin who was murdered, who said that it was a black man who committed the crime and identified Mays as the murderer. And he said, "That couldn't be. I've never been in this neighborhood before. I don't know anybody here." Mays was taken to the Knox County Jail. And Mayor McMillan had gotten him out of trouble early on when he was about 17 years old. So people thought that McMillan would get him out of this.
He's already expressing fears to the sheriff. It's not safe. They're going to try to lynch me. There was apparently a brief mention in the morning paper, the Knoxville Journal and Tribune, to the effect that a white woman had been killed and a black man arrested. It's not entirely clear what it was. It was apparently probably a one-page extra. That has not survived. Word gets around very quickly. Bertie Lindsay's body is being prepared at Robert's funeral home, which is near Market Square. Market Square is the traditional gathering place. There are restaurants, the old market house, saloons. By mid-morning, people are already beginning to come to the funeral home, passing through and staying at Market Square to congregate. It's Saturday. Now, in those days, typically businesses worked half a day on Saturday. So around noon, everybody starts to get off work. It's Labor Day weekend. Some people immediately start getting watered down for the weekend. Around the same time, the afternoon paper, the Knoxville Sentinel, hits the street. Now, we don't know exactly what that day's edition said because, again, no copies of that have survived. And apparently, there were some inflammatory statements in the articles that there was at least a picture of Bertie Lindsay and apparently some sort of a headline that was sensational. Again, we don't know exactly what that was. Not too long after the paper hits the street, the sheriff begins noticing that things are definitely starting to turn ugly, and it's time to do something.
When word got out that he was the murderer of a white woman, a mob formed. Now, this was very unusual for Knoxville. Mobs just didn't form in Knoxville to string anybody up. In fact, in all of my reading, I have yet to find where somebody has been lynched in Knox County. I mean, the sheriff did a lot of legal lynchings, but this never happened. The sheriff knew the mob was coming and devised a plan to take Mays to safety.
He borrows one of his wife's dresses. They dress Maurice Mays up, sneak him out, take him by car down to Concord, slip him aboard the train there, and out of town. Now, meanwhile, back at the jail, the crowd keeps forming. In an effort to get the crowd to disperse, the chief deputy, Carol Kate, agrees to let a committee of men come through and inspect the jail. "We'll show you he's not here." So they take them through, take them all around. They come out and they say, "Well, we can't find him." "Well, the crowd's not satisfied." So they put together another committee, bring them through, and then a third, and then a fourth, at which point some people in the crowd start shouting, "We're just going to follow him in and see for ourselves." And then they slam the doors. In between the searches, Jeff Claiborne, one of the ringleaders, has made his way up to Market Square. There's a bigger crowd forming up there. Some of these are people who've been to the funeral home. Some of them are people just drinking, getting ready for the weekend. He starts addressing the crowd. Carol Kate, the chief deputy, later estimated it was as many as 4,000 or 5,000 people. Someone gives the command, "March, boys." So a lot of these guys are World War I veterans. Some are Spanish-American veterans. There are even accounts that some of the riders arrested were as old as in their 70s. Some of them were Civil War veterans. They march down Market Street, counting off, military style,
until they just basically surround the jail. They refuse the final offer to search, and at that point, they tear down a telephone pole, start using that as a battering ram. The main door's whole, but there's a side door that proves to be a little bit weaker, and finally use dynamite to blast their way in. Once they're inside, it's a free-for-all. Most of the deputies basically give up, stand back. They know they're outnumbered. They turn all the prisoners loose. Interestingly, they leave the black prisoners untouched.
They tore up the jail to the tune of $50,000. And that was a lot of money in 1919 to have to suffer that kind of damage. They drank up all the confiscated moonshine whiskey and other whiskeys that were there and got drunk and left the jail vowing to kill every black person they saw in revenge.
The National Guard was summoned. By the time the soldiers do arrive, they're still outnumbered by the crowd. The adjutant general addresses the crowd, tries to reassure them that justice is going to be done. You might as well go home. That doesn't work. There's an expectation in the black community that this is going to be taken out on us. They've found Maurice Mays to blame, but they're going to blame all of us.
But the black community was aware of this, and men who were in gun clubs and who were hunters decided to meet the mob head on. So there were a number of men returning from World War I, and they just said, we're not going to take this anymore. They perhaps, before that time, bit their tongues and put up with it, swallowed deeply and put up with it, counted to 10 and put up with it. But having fought in that war, they decided, we're just tired of this stuff and we're just not going to take it anymore. And I think that was the difference.
When the rumor reaches the mob that black men are holding up white people at Vine and Central, which was not true, there's no evidence that that was happening, the mob surges up Gay Street towards Vine, and the guard joins them. They later said they were restoring order. Basically, they were just siding with the whites. The mob starts breaking into stores all along Gay Street and the surrounding streets, stealing guns, knives, baseball bats, any type of weapon they can get their hands on. They surge out toward Vine Street. The whites are basically amassed up here at Vine and Gay. Down at Vine and Central, in the black community, they have made siege preparations. They've shot out the street lights. There are reports that there was furniture, box crates, that sort of thing, stacked in the streets to create barricades. And it becomes a standoff at that point. National Guard has their machine guns. They bring them in on the back of a truck. They set one up near Vine and Gay. They set them up on each side of the street in a crossfire. The guys manning them are not experienced machine gunners. A lot of them are mostly kids. Some of them are as young as 15, 16 years old. Most of them have not been in battle. There was one lieutenant who tried to make his way down to the corner of Vine and Central to scout out what was going on. He gets wounded by fire from the black side, staggers out into the street. Someone in the mob screams, "Let him have it." And at that point, one of the machine gunners panics and basically just starts spraying the street with bullets. He's caught in the crossfire and almost literally sawn in half. And it takes several minutes for the officers to get the machine gun crew back under control. The main fighting near Vine and Central lasts for several hours, at least up into the morning of the following day. There was fighting all along Central Avenue, which was essentially the border of the black community. People were fighting on the bridges. There are accounts of the black men trying to literally charge the machine gun nests, World War I over-the-top style, and being mown down. At some point during the battle, it starts to rain. The general description from both sides was that Vine Avenue was a river of blood. The real toll is probably never going to be known. The official count was first 5, then 2. One casualty being Lieutenant Payne, the other being Joe Etter, a black Spanish-American veteran, storekeeper, who was acknowledged as one of the leaders on the black side. How many more? There are all kinds of accounts.
Every time I hear the story, somebody has added something to it, and it gets so ridiculous. For example, I heard from somebody else that when they were building the city-county building, that they unearthed this mass grave. And somebody said it was from bodies from the race riot of 1919. I've heard that. And I've heard so many stories about it that really just don't add up. And so the more people hear about it 20th hand, the more the story is embellished.
Knoxville is under basically martial law for the next few days, pretty much through the Labor Day weekend. Mayor authorizes special deputies, dozens of people deputized, issued guns, and asked to basically patrol their communities. There's some question as to how much order the special deputies actually kept and how much disorder they actually started. There were rumors of, in white communities, of invasions by roaming bands of armed black men. Same thing happened in the black community, accounts of roving bands of white men running around. The phone rang off the hook at the police department for the next few days with reports of all these things, and the majority of it was not true. Most of the guns taken during the break-ins on Gay Street never came back. The owners went so far as to run huge ads in the newspaper saying, please return our guns and you won't be prosecuted, no questions asked, but they never got it back. There was a trial. There was actually more than one trial. There was a mass indictment. There were 55 men and women, all of them white, ultimately arrested and charged with some role in the riot. All but five were acquitted. Charges against three were dropped before it ever got to the jury. The jury deadlocked on two men. Neither served more than a year's jail time. Maurice Mays is brought back to Knoxville. He was given a fairly sizable defense team of court-appointed lawyers. Chief counsel was Reuben Cates. There was William Yardley assisting. He also had two other lawyers, but Cates was the chief counsel. Prosecution was handled by the local district attorney, Rufus Minot. Within about a month or so of the riot, the jury deliberated about 18 minutes before finding him guilty of murder. The defense at the first trial made the effort to introduce testimony from some white women who were willing to testify that they had been assaulted in the same fashion as Bertie Lindsay and Ora Smith after Maurice Mays' arrest. The judge refused to allow that. That number would increase in later years. The attacks on women continued long after his arrest.
Maurice Mays could handle the English language very well. In fact, when he was in prison, he wrote a number of letters to people across the country asking for support. He wrote poetry. There were people like James G. Beck in Knoxville, a prominent black person, who asked for help from the national NAACP to help them raise funds to help Mays with his defense. The NAACP had problems all across the country because there were at least 25 cities in turmoil with these race riots. And of course, there were other problems that the NAACP was concerned with. There were many, many lynchings in the United States that they were concerned with. So they just didn't have the money to share. Even though there were a number of appeals from Knoxville to help the situation. But what intrigues me more than that is that there were prominent black men in Knoxville who had money, who could have contributed to the cause, but they did not. And I don't know whether they were intimidated, whether they thought there would be repercussions if they contributed to the cause. And the pastor at Mount Zion Baptist Church, who was heading up the fundraiser, said he didn't understand it either. He said, there are these people of means, but they are as silent as clams.
He's tried once. He's convicted. The judge gives the verdict his hearty approval and sentences Maurice Mays to death. By the second trial in 1921, the number of women who are willing to testify that they've been attacked in the same manner after Mays' arrest has increased to 15. And that includes one woman who says that the man stuck a gun in her face and said, lay still or I'll kill you like I did that Lindsay woman. Again, the judge refuses to allow that testimony. Again, he's convicted. Again, the defense appeals. This time, they're turned down. The case goes before the governor now.
Governor Taylor, won't you please come out to the prison to see me? I am eager and very anxious to explain to you personally some valuable information that you should certainly know. Please, allow me to urgently beg for your presence. Humbly yours, Maurice Mays, Death Chamber.
He appealed to the governor and everybody else. The newly formed Knoxville NAACP got involved in the case and they attempted to raise money for his defense, but none of that did any good. So Mays was eventually sent to the electric chair in March of 1922. And I always say that he really wasn't electrocuted for murdering the white woman, because I never saw any evidence of that in any of the court transcripts that I read. But he went to the electric chair for dealing with white women, which was a real taboo in 1919. So he paid with his life for that indiscretion rather than being convicted of the murder for which he was accused. There was a funeral in Knoxville, but there were people in Knoxville who didn't want the funeral here because they didn't want to stir up trouble. Finally, the pastor at Logan Temple, AME Zion, where his parents were members, agreed to conduct the funeral. When he got up to do the eulogy, he said, "You've all read the obituary. You know the story of the decedent. Undertaker, take charge." And that was basically the sermon at the funeral. Now, thousands of people attended. They walked past the casket, both blacks and whites.
Now, what's happening in the first two decades of the 20th century to make it such a fertile moment for racial violence, mob violence of all kinds? The violence of the early 20th century seems to become almost predictable. And I think part of that is the way in which the justification for lynching becomes elevated to the point where it's incorporated into American popular music, into American popular film, like Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith's epic movie, which is really a call for white supremacy. What was being elevated was the idea that African-American men were primitive, brutal, violent, and prone to transgress against whites, but especially white women. So that notion of the black rapist got elevated in the early 20th century. And we can only imagine the effect of incorporating that image into a movie that was so unprecedented in its cultural impact. There's no way we can come up with a contemporary analogy. Birth of a Nation provided an incredibly visceral film rendition of the black threat. And that's 4 years before Knoxville. It's 4 years before the Red Summer.
In From Race Riot to Sit-In, Arthur I. Waskow categorized Knoxville's Red Summer with Omaha, Nebraska's unrest as a particular form of violence. The Jailhouse Riot. The two jailhouse riots of 1919 had a number of peculiar features. Both were connected with local political rivalries and the control of underworld activities. Both originated in anger at a black man accused of rape. Both were stopped before the initial incident could turn into a full-scale riot between the races. And both events were...
Welcome back. And that was, of course, a audio documentary on the 1919 race massacre in Knoxville, Tennessee. And before that, we heard one on the situation in Elaine, Arkansas. And that's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. And if you'd like to have access to this program, all you need to do is go to our website, and that's at the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful, beautiful week. Thank you.